and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris, and you're watching The Future is Female. This is the show where we want to find the extraordinary in every woman. I'm delighted to introduce my guest tonight. Her name is Professor Loredana Padurian. She is an Associate Dean and Faculty Director for Action Learning at Asia School of Business, which was established in collaboration with MIT Sloan. Loredana, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited. I've heard so much about you. I know you're such a big inspiration to so many people. Thank you.
That is very kind. Thank you. Thanks so much for saying that and for being on the show. Now, I too have been wanting to speak to you for a long time, and I'm glad that we've managed to do that now that we're both kind of working from home and locked down and indoors, and now there's time to discuss. I see you have a very beautiful virtual background behind you. You tell me that that is part of your hometown. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
So I was born in Romania, in Transylvania. I think you've heard of Transylvania before, and this actually happens to be my farm. I haven't been there in exactly 1 year to the day, and I miss it very much. I have a bunch of dogs and cats, and this is my happy place. So I think everybody's trying to find a happy place, virtual or physical, these days. So this is my
Exactly, we are. We're trying to find anything that can give us some happiness. So Loredana, I want to begin our conversation by asking, by talking a little bit about, you know, the fact that you've been called the unconventional professor. It's also the title of your podcast, as I understand it. I'm wondering, do you consider yourself an unconventional professor? Is that something that you're proud of, or is it more of what you, how you think you're perceived by others, and therefore you've just embraced it?
Well, that's such a great question. Nobody has ever asked me that question. So I have to tell you, I'm an accidental professor. I never intended to become one. And the truth is, I never seen anybody like me. I don't know about you, Melissa, but most of my professors, no offense, they were good, but they were older men in a very traditional suit, speaking in a very traditional conservative way. And I never wanted to be a professor until I accidentally went to school and I got a scholarship and I was encouraged to pursue my education. And until I went to visit MIT, I have never seen anybody like me. And I remember walking in a classroom at MIT as a guest and seeing a professor who was literally on the walls and singing and chanting and getting the room energized. And I felt like, oh my God, things can be different. So in a way, I'm a product of a very different academic profile. But also I want to tell you, ever since I moved to Malaysia, which is exactly 6 years ago, the first reaction that people have when they see me or when they meet me for the first time, they say, you're a professor, but you don't look like a professor. So I'm a little bit of combination of both. I think I sort of owned my unconventionality, which was applied on me by the environment. And now, yeah, I think I'm proud to be calling myself and allowing others to call me an unconventional professor.
Okay. When you say that there isn't anybody like you, or you didn't see anybody like you, What does that mean? How do you see yourself? And more importantly, how do other people expect a professor to be like? What was the expectation that perhaps you did not quite match, proudly didn't match?
So initially, most of my professors, like I said, they were men. They were in their, I would say maybe late 50s, late 60s. They had this very, whatever the stereotype of a professor that you have, somebody who's very a bookwormy almost. They have a very boring way of speaking. And I've never, I don't know about you, but I've never seen a woman professor, or at least a young one. When I went to Switzerland to study in Switzerland, I didn't have one female professor, with one exception. And she was young and vibrant and very attractive. And she stood out in this massive sea of, you know, homogeneity. And I thought, somebody can be like that, right? And I think what strikes people about people or situations that come out of a stereotype is when you don't look like somebody expects you to, when you don't behave like somebody expects you to. And I think of myself as a very normal person. I think I'm vibrant and exciting and intense and intimidating. This is what my students tell me. But I don't think that has to be outside of the professorial field. It's just that we are not used to see this kind of profiling.
Can I ask you, has that ever been a setback? I mean, because you don't match what most people expect of an academic, particularly in a professorial role, has that ever worked in your detriment?
If I wouldn't be a bulldozer, maybe. But I have to say, very few things intimidate me because I grew up in a very rough environment and I developed a very thick skin very early on. But I would say probably for somebody who wouldn't be strong or confident, this would be a detriment. I have to say the first 5 or 10 minutes of an interaction, of a conversation are a little bit funny now. Maybe in the beginning they were a little bit uncomfortable for me because somebody would challenge me instantly. Like, how can you be a professor? You don't look like one. You're too young or too pretty, which by the way, I never realized that you can be too pretty for a job. I think I'm that pretty. I was too pretty for the job, or that I'm too outspoken, or that I'm too fashionable, which is another thing. You're too fashionable to be something. And I always thought, if I'm an engineer, if I'm a truck driver, if I'm a school intendant, if I'm a professor, if I'm a prime minister, I cannot wear jewelry, I cannot wear beautiful clothing. Does that affect my ethos, my intellectual capabilities? No. But I think because we are so used to put people in boxes, to force somebody to be who we want them to be, that makes us uncomfortable. Therefore, I'm an unconventional professor to people who expect a certain conventional feature out of me.
Right. Well, you mentioned a bit earlier that you were born halfway around the world in a small town in Romania. Can you talk to us a little bit about your journey? I'm curious to know about your backstory, how you got here today, the milestones for you to become a professor at one of the biggest MBA programs in Asia. I read somewhere, Loredana, that one of your jobs early in your career was as on a TV show, on the Fashion Police TV show in Romania. How did you come from there to all the way to being a professor here in the Asia School of Business?
So I have to tell you, I had 19 different professions before I became a professor. Like I said, I'm an accidental professor. I did anything from a little bit of TV, obviously not as good as you, but I did life insurance. I used to work in sales. I was a dispatch. I was a secretary. I worked in hospitality. I was a cook. I was a cleaning lady. I worked in agriculture. Oh my God, I've done a few more things. I can't remember them all now. There is a colorful historical journey, and then there's the professional journey. So it depends which one you want. But I would say at the high level, so I was raised in Romania. I went to college there. All this time I had these multiple jobs because my country at that point was, on one hand, coming out of communism along with the rest of East Europe, but also we were going through our first massive economic recession, high political instability, so the environment was very difficult. I remember having to have at least two full-time jobs a month to be able to pay half the rent. So that was very tough. And maybe that's why I was a little bit so intrapreneurial and entrepreneurial. But then 2 years after my college, after I failed in my first startup, I realized that I might have great ideas, but I actually don't really know anything about the world of business. So I went to school in Switzerland. I was one of the founding members of the class. It was a brand new school. They were not doing a very well managed job, if I can say so. And I became a manager of the program very early on because it was either that or I was going to quit. And then they offered me a scholarship to become to become a PhD student. And I really didn't want to do that because, like I said, I've never seen anybody like me. And I think this is why I appreciate shows like yours, because we underestimate the value of seeing somebody that you admire, seeing somebody that you relate to, right? But I'm sure when women or young girls, they see you on the screen, they believe that this is possible.
Oh, that's so lovely.
My case, I didn't really believe it was possible because, like I said, I haven't really found any inspirational future or people. But I managed to, by the grace of God or whoever you believe in, I managed to interact with some very kind and smart people from MIT who encouraged me to say yes to a scholarship, because they said the only investment you should never say no to is in yourself and in your education. And because of that, I got the scholarship to join a PhD program. But this is where the fun story starts once again. I was one of the first PhD students in my school, and they didn't really have a program yet. So they said, why don't you go and create your own program? And I didn't want to sit in front of at that point, not even a computer, but I didn't want to sit in front of, you know, a board and write papers and things like that. So I did what MIT calls action research. So instead of writing pieces, I took over, Melissa, a bankrupted ski resort in Switzerland, and we turned it around in 2 years. So I had that experience. And after living in this Swiss village mountain, 38 people, average age, I think 72 or 73, that's another story. I decided I'm gonna go, I graduated from my PhD program and I wanted to move back to Boston, where I spent a little bit of time when I took some courses at Harvard and at MIT. And then I became a professor very, very early on. My PhD was very fast because I don't have patience. And then when I was in Boston, I was approached by MIT to see if I would be interested to teach in India. And I've never been in India before. And I said, of course I'm gonna go to India. I mean, how hard can it be to teach at an MBA program in India? And it turns out it wasn't easy, but it was fun. And from there, sort of remained in conversations with MIT. And when Bank Negara Malaysia, especially Tan Sri Dr. Zetty, approached MIT Sloan to consider building a business school in Malaysia, I was one of the first in their mind, because I already went to India and I think I was bold enough, maybe crazy enough, I don't know what exactly they thought. And I'm very, very say that I'm one of the first hires here. So I came to Kuala Lumpur.
That's wonderful to hear. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, but Loredana, I want to hear more about your work with action learning, because I think it's really an interesting approach. It's an experience-based approach, but I'm wondering how the pandemic has caused a shift in the way things are going to work in the future. So let's take a quick break. We'll come back and talk about that. So stay tuned. We'll be back with more on The Future's Female. Hi, welcome back to The Future's Female. I'm Melissa Idris, and I'm chatting tonight to Professor Loredana Paduran. She's a global entrepreneurial academic with the Asia School of Business in collaboration with MIT Sloan. I want to talk a little bit, Loredana, about how the pandemic is redefining leadership, redefining entrepreneurship, and skills that are needed for the future. This program that's under your portfolio at the Asia School of Business has been called one of the most innovative MBA programs in the world, thanks to the action learning curriculum design, which you're looking at, that's under your portfolio. Action learning, that's all about experience-based approach. How has the pandemic changed action learning from your point of view?
So I have to say, until a year ago, we were riding the wave of being the most innovative MBA in the world. Our students were, doing every semester a project in a different country in Southeast Asia and even beyond. I'm very proud to say that in less than 4 years, we had projects in 22 countries, and we were so excited about the progress. And when the pandemic hit, obviously, initially, we thought it's going to be a couple of months. Then it turned out into 5 and 6 months. We had to... on Zoom. Like you said, action learning is very experience based. So how are you going to experience the pain of a company on Zoom? It turns out that because everybody went on Zoom, in a way it wasn't that bad. Had we only had to go on Zoom, that would have been a lot worse. But one of the good things about action learning is that you learn as a student in action by being immersed in the practical experience of the company that you work with. You observe how they work, you work with them, and you work with them for an objective. So when all our partners had to go online, we also went online along with them. And I have to say, as terrible this year of lockdown was, I think it developed skills that probably never before we would have thought that we need. For example, how do you communicate virtually? How do you develop executive presence in a digital space? How do you build empathy and relations when the only interaction that we have is this one? How do you communicate across 5 continents? Melissa, we have students in 5 continents, 12 time zones. One of them pops when the other one goes to sleep. So it turns out that team management, self-management, stakeholder management became a lot more complex, but also a lot more interesting. So it changed everything, and in a way, it didn't change anything, if it makes sense.
Are there limitations? I mean, you talked a lot about the the need to learn how to communicate virtually. That's not something that's taught generally. It's something that you learn through trial and error. When you're looking at problem solving through action learning, immersing yourself in the problems of a business, trying to figure out where the intangibles are, how do you do that through Zoom? I mean, are there limitations to your ability to fully immerse in operations of a business, both the operations, but also the intangible problems?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It's hard enough to get a grip on the culture of a company when you're immersed, let alone when everything happens on Zoom. I don't know in your case, but I think because we have such a Zoom fatigue, we're sort of skipping the humanity of some of the meetings, right? We don't really ask each other how you're doing because the answer is always the same anyway. We don't get to see how people interact among themselves in an organization to pay attention to cues. So I am actually teaching virtual executive presence or digital executive presence, that's how I call it. And I ask my students to sharpen their senses a lot more, to pay obsessive attention to things that otherwise they wouldn't have, to try to over communicate because you get so many things lost in the Zoom translation, to not take things for granted, to try to build an emotional connection with the Zoomer, even if you're only seeing them for the first or maybe for the last time in that engagement. But absolutely, Zoom is not reality. Zoom is not an environment that allows you to build this emotional connection. However, you can't really say, I'm going to wait until the world gets better. So we have to deal with it.
There's no time to waste, right? This is the time where we have to learn new skills. And speaking about that, I really love how you brought up that this is a new skill we need to learn, this virtual communication. Are there other skills that have changed dramatically that will be required in this new normal world? I'm wondering also, Loredana, because for me personally, my approach to life and work and money and skills and what I think are important in terms of communication, that's changed in the past year. When it comes to entrepreneurs, when it comes to active learning, are you incorporating those changes? Do you feel that things have changed?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And we felt that things were changing maybe by April last year. It's also the case, Melissa, that because we were always extremely innovative, even before the pandemic happened, for us, it wasn't such a dramatic change of muscle, right? When you're constantly changing, when you're constantly on the edge of innovation, if something disruptive happens, it hits you, but it doesn't hit you as bad as if you were still in an inertia mode. So speaking of skills, one of the things that I'm working on these days is a reinterpretation of the traditional soft and hard skills semantics. Because I don't believe that any of the skills that we think they are soft. There's nothing soft about managing people, validating people, dealing with complex environments, communication. So I call these skills smart skills, because if you don't have them, you're not very smart.
well, Loredana, the idea of soft skills, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but people seem to box soft skills into people management skills, into communication skills, almost always EQ skills, your emotional quotient. You're saying that that's not soft skills, that that's actually something that we really need. It's something we need in our daily life or professional lives.
I really hope that a couple of years from now on, you're going to invite me back and I'll present to you my second book. And the title is The Job is Easy, The People Are Not. So think about you and everybody else who's listening to this. 80% of the challenges in your job come from people and yourself, right? So why do we call these skills soft? Again, there's nothing soft about them. So what I'm doing, I created my own top 10 smart skills that I think you need in dealing with the world, not just with people, but with the world, including yourself. For example, one of the primary skills I'm looking for when I work with somebody, and it's because I don't have it, that's why I said it's a self skill, is emotional maturity. In this environment of intense stress, how many times did you lose your cool this year versus the year before that? A lot more, right? So emotional maturity for me, it's a smart skill, not a soft skill. It's a smart skill that requires you to better understand how to manage your own emotions and the emotions of others. Seeing that if you're a manager that all of a sudden had to redeploy her entire workforce. Now everybody has to work from home. You have 3 kids, 2 cats, a husband, you know, you have to do laundry. You don't have a maid, which by the way, it's a luxury that we have here in Asia. How are you going to keep your act together? How are you going to keep your emotions together? There's nothing soft about that. When a manager loses their capacity to manage their own emotions, they lose their productivity. Another skill that I think it's very important these days is the need for validation. You know, if the two of us were together right now in person, very small gestures, you know, me maybe gently touching your hand and saying, I'm here with you, Melissa. You know, I feel you. We don't do that. We can't do that. Let alone I'm talking to myself on the screen, right? The need for validation, for self-validation and validation of others, it's even more important these days. And I can go on and on like this forever because, like I said, I came up with my own top 10 smart skills and also a top 10 sharp skills, which are the category of technical skills, but we can talk about that next time.
Okay, we will definitely come back and have a longer conversation about the smart skills. But just to follow up on that note, because a lot of these skills are vital, necessary when you're in positions of leadership. And I'm wondering, Loredana, if in your point of view, there is a gendered dimension to leadership, or whether good leadership is just a matter of personality and that and gender doesn't even come into it. The reason I ask is because, you know, I keep seeing all these news headlines about how women-led nations are doing much better when it comes to the COVID-19 pandemic management. You know, you've got New Zealand and Taiwan. How are you looking at this? Do you think there is a gender dimension to leadership?
I have to say, I'm a little bit uncomfortable to think that because I'm a woman, I can be a better leader, because then there's an implication that because you're a man, you're better at something else. I actually think for me, leadership is not one thing. For me, my leadership is different than yours, Melissa. You can't really say, this is the leadership profile, this is the leadership book, you have to learn how to do this. I think you probably lead with, I don't know, more empathy. Maybe I lead with more authority. I think if you're looking at how the management of pandemic was done in these 3 or 4 countries, yes, they managed it better, but maybe they also managed the country better before pandemic. Mm. I mean, if you look at the countries that didn't manage the pandemic well, they also didn't manage it well up to that point. I mean, it's not that United States just hit the, you know, the lottery 2020. They were not doing very well 3 years before that. So I am very uncomfortable as a strong feminist. So ladies, please don't hate on me right now. But as a feminist, I am uncomfortable to say that this is female leadership and this is male leadership. For me, successful leadership, ethical leadership, empathetic leadership, and if you happen to have a set of breasts with that, fine, but I don't want to be considered a female leader. You know, nobody calls my boss a male leader. Why do I have to be called a female leader?
So I agree.
That's all I'm going to say.
Okay. All right. Well, my last question to you, Loredana. In your podcast, you describe yourself as an unapologetic woman. And I love that line. And I want to delve a little bit deeper into that, because I wish when I was younger, someone told me, Melissa, it's okay to be an unapologetic woman. You don't have to be sorry for who you are, be sorry for taking space in the world. How would you define an unapologetic woman? And what would you say to yourself if you had known that earlier in your life, in your career?
I so wish, just like you said, I so wish that somebody told me that when I was 10 or 12 or 15 or 25 or even 35. I think, I don't know about you, a lot of people say that this is an Asian thing. I think it's a global thing. I was told as a girl to be good. Be good. If you don't, if you're not good, people won't like you. If you're not quiet, you know, people will be upset. You should care about what people think. What do you think people will say if you do this? And I have to say, you listen to, you constantly listen to these voices, and at some point it's going to break you. Unless you stand up and you say, you know what, with all due respect to people, I have to take care of myself first. And this is the problem that I think a lot of women have, because we are not allowed to put ourselves first. This becomes a very self-centric, a very, you know, bossy feature, somebody who is arrogant, right? So this becomes, mm-hmm. instead of becoming something that is self-care, it becomes, you know, self-promoting. And when right. I realized that actually by saying no to these voices, I start to take care of myself, I didn't know who I am. I didn't know who I was. And the day when I said, you know what? I am who I am. I am loud. I am intense. I am intimidating. I am smart. I have a big mouth. I am pretty. I love fashion. I want to be a professor like nobody has ever seen before. If that's your problem, don't be in my space. My space, and there's no room for you in that space. But once again, you need to have a strong thing, a thick skin to do that, because there's so much pressure of convention put on top of women, and you have to shake it off.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I'm really happy to hear you say that. I think that's a wonderful note to end the show on. I'm going to go back and digest all these wisdom, pearls of wisdom that you've passed on to us. Thank you so much, Loredana, for being on the show. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I'm a big fan.
Thank you. Stay safe, Loredana. That's all we have for you on this episode of The Futures Female. I'm Melissa Idris, and I will be back with more conversations next week, same time, same day. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.